Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Barbara Lang. Lang is currently an undergraduate advisor at Cornell University's School of Hotel Administration after 17 years as a lecturer. She is founder of First Impressions, Second Steps, a business etiquette company, and author of From Restaurant to Retail, a handbook for food professionals. Lang is also a veteran of colon cancer. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Now, you spent your career in some form of food service and business leadership. What got you interested in these subjects?
Actually, it was probably my father. And I grew up on Long Island, and my dad worked in New York City. And when I was in high school, he started to take me to restaurants in New York City. And we grew up actually going to one particular restaurant called Oscar's on 2nd Avenue. And he went there a couple times a week. And when I went to college and I had started to go to the hotel school, I remember going to Oscar's and Oscar giving me his reservation sheet where I had to start calling out names. And I think I was just hooked.
And what was it that hooked you, though? The thought of running a restaurant or food? Well, what was the real hook?
I think pleasing people.
Ah, so you wanted to be in service.
I did. I really enjoyed that. And I found that I even pursued that when I was in high school. I just liked activities that dealt with people, that offered people something. It gave me satisfaction. Still does.
I would assume so, because you followed that thread throughout your whole life. Now, you were at the hotel school as a student and have been as a teacher. How has the philosophy around teaching in the hotel school changed through all these many years? You started as a student in the 70s?
I did.
Has the philosophy changed in regard to service?
I don't know about the philosophy towards service. Certainly the curriculum has changed dramatically. When I was in school, it was much more hands-on. It was much more people going into the industry and being in the front lines and then getting promoted within the industry. Today, it's a business school with a focus on hospitality.
Uh-huh. Do you consider it kind of a science? On how to deal with people and serve people, as you say?
A science. I don't know if it's a science. There's a great book, and it's written by Danny Meyer. It's about enlightened hospitality. Setting the Table is the name of it. And I think his philosophy pretty much hits it on the head. And it's about 51%. In other words, you have to have it in your bones of having that kind of orientation. And the rest you can be taught. But I think a person has to be oriented a certain way. I don't know if I'd call it a science as much as an awareness.
You have to have a certain personality, right?
You do. You need to recognize that the position is one of value and not one of servitude. And I think that's where some people have a very different attitude towards it. And that it is about recognizing what a person wants and then giving them what they want. And not every person is going to want the same thing. Mm-hmm. So it's really about being able to acknowledge what their needs are and then be able to provide those needs, even before they might even know they want them.
I was going to say you have to be sort of a psychologist, too, because a lot of people don't know what they want. I've gone to restaurants with people who go crazy if the menu's too big. And so, you get the food service person to help them navigate.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. You know, I always, when I do the etiquette sessions, I always ask people whether or not they've been a server. Because if you've been a server, you understand there are some people who really want to talk to you and be engaged and find out something about you. Other people, you're anonymous. And it's not about what you want. It's recognizing what they want and then being able to accommodate them. And then I go into the business etiquette training in the same way of how you deal with people, providing that same kind of sensitivity.
Mm-hmm. And you do have to like people. I'm sure you can probably tell if someone's a server just as a job to make money or if someone really enjoys the whole aspect of being a server and liking people and working with people, eh?
One of my best servers was at Denny's restaurant.
Really?
Yes, this kid was just terrific. And one of my worst experiences was at a top restaurant in New York City. I'm not going to say the name of it because it'll come back to bite me. But it was terrible service. I was a single diner, and the person clearly already tabulated that I wasn't going to be providing very much revenue for them, and I wasn't having alcohol. So in their head, the check went down even more, and they ignored me. Whereas at Denny's, it was about me looking at a picture on a menu and getting the food and saying, this food doesn't look like that picture at all. I mean, not even in any sense. And the server was right there with me. And he was just had this great personality. And, you know, we found a solution. And I think the tip was just about as much as the bill.
Yeah, I know that all of us on our service stories. Do you think the landscape has changed in regard to single diners? There used to be such prejudice against single diners.
You know, I don't think there's a prejudice against single diners as much as people don't recognize really where to seat a single diner. And I'll give you a very quick example. I was at a restaurant, Banffy's, at the Statler Hotel, and at the time with my partner, who's now my husband, Dave, and there was a single diner, and they had placed her between two tables that were full tables, and they had her in such a position that she really couldn't have any privacy. And I remember looking at her, and she reminded me of my former mother-in-law, and I went up to her, and I invited her to join us for dinner. Uh-huh. It happened to have been Janet Reno.
You're kidding
me.
No,
and she looked, and she said, I'd be delighted. And she ended up joining us for dinner. But the point is, there was a person, clearly, even though they had a book, it was very hard for them to find any kind of a space to actually have privacy, but not feel as though they've been stuck in a corner.
Yeah.
Yes, people were a little surprised when they would walk by, and they knew me because I worked there, and they saw her, and even the general manager came up and, is everything okay? You know, is she bothering you? You know, he'd say to Janet Reno, and she would assure everybody that, no, I was not bothering her.
Wow, what an experience that was. Now, you have a business called First Impressions, Second Steps. It offers seminars on business etiquette. Tell us what you mean by business etiquette.
It is about, and I've done this really on the Cornell campus. I've done over 50 presentations to a variety of groups on campus. And it's having students become aware about how do they convey the message about themselves that they want to convey. And very often, people have unintentional off-messaging because of the way that they behave. And etiquette is about respecting, acknowledging, and appreciating other people. And that's what etiquette is. And business etiquette is how do you do that in a way in the business and your professional development so that you are acknowledging and appreciating and respecting people and getting the message across about yourself so that people understand what it is you have to offer them. And that's what business etiquette is. And I often combine it with dining etiquette because when you're dining and the reason people take you to a restaurant is because it really is parallel to how you'll behave in an office. And so I show those parallels, and it's a fun time. People enjoy it, and they learn a great deal.
Has business etiquette, like navigation, changed a bit in this high-tech world in regard to cell phones and people texting and bringing computers?
Yes, and it depends on what generation you're talking to. And if you're talking about today's generation in college and they're interviewing with somebody who's of my generation and I'm now 54, those are very different generations. And if they look at their cell phone because they're looking at the time, I think they're checking their text messages. Whereas if someone's interviewing them from their generation, they might feel quite comfortable with that. So you have to be very sensitive towards what's appropriate and what's not.
But there's still rudeness is pretty universal, right?
Yes, I think you can be rude. You could have an enormous level of sophistication and be remarkably rude.
Yeah. Because I find it quite rude. I don't know if the people who are sitting with the people, when I go to restaurants and people are looking on their cell phones when they're sitting across from somebody, you know?
Someone had a great example, and it was, if it's appropriate for you to take out a crossword puzzle at any moment, then probably that also is an appropriate moment to look at your cell phone. So if you're in the middle of a conversation in a restaurant and you pull out a crossword puzzle, clearly that's not appropriate. So you can assume that probably pulling out your cell phone is also not appropriate.
I wish more people would assume that. Now, you wrote a book called From Restaurant to Retail, Handbook for Food Professionals. What was that about?
That was actually based on my master's thesis, and it's about restaurants, food professionals, innkeepers having a food product that they serve and then packaging it and bringing it to market. That market could be on the shelf in their establishment. It could be at specialty food stores. It could be at national grocery stores. It could be online. But it's really about taking a product and bringing it to retail. And I speak quite often. This year I spoke on the topic at the Fancy Food Show in New York City, at the National Restaurant Show, and at the Innkeepers Association.
Have people gotten more sophisticated about food? In the last 20, 30 years? I mean, are people more daring in regard to ethnic
foods?
Oh,
without a doubt. I think that's because of the melting pot of people. It's because of the food channel. It's because you have access to the travel that people do now. There are all different avenues that people might be exposed to food. Just look at the local Wegmans. The kind of products they've got on the shelf now, you wouldn't dream of a grocery store having 10 years ago.
I always attribute it to travel. People being able to cross borders and bring back.
Or watching Tony Bourdain traveling, whoever it may be.
Now, you tried your hand at running and owning a restaurant a while back. And what was that experience like? So tell us about it.
Well, it's like being a host of a nightly party, or you can look at it as being the MC of theater every night. But it is a show when those doors open. And it's really about providing the show that everybody wants. It was exhilarating. It was exhausting. It was satisfying. And it was also draining.
Oh, I'll bet. And it's so difficult. For anybody who doesn't know, Barbara owned Coyote Loco, which was quite a well-known and popular place for a few years until it went out.
I co-owned it with three other people.
So you describe it almost like theater.
It was. And people, you think about it, people go out to dinner, and in a sense, it's entertainment, very much so. Mm-hmm. And it's about providing that entertainment.
Do you think you'd ever do it again? Was it an experience that drained you so much that you'd never try it again?
I don't think that I would do a restaurant again. I know that I'll be doing different projects, and they'll probably deal with food, but I don't think that I want a restaurant per se. You're married to a restaurant, and I'm a little selfish now with my time, and I don't want that kind of commitment.
Yeah, I talked to the people who founded Moosewood, and that's quite a commitment, too.
Yes.
It's an institution, in fact, for them. Now, has the advent of buying local and organic foods, Alice Waters philosophy, has that permeated the cultures? And do you talk about that at the hotel school? And when you're talking
I don't
about
teach at the hotel school anymore, so I advise students.
Uh-huh.
So I really can't speak on what the faculty talk about. I think across campus, there are different avenues where that's a very hot topic about sustainability, about, you know, right here we have the Finger Lakes Culinary Bounty, and that is really a consortium of farmers and vendors, restaurateurs who are really trying to make it as local and seasonal as possible, and they're doing a terrific job.
Yeah. Do you as a consumer try to go after local foods and organic foods? Has it reached you personally?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, without a doubt. I used to have a CSA when I lived on West Hill, and I don't anymore I live in Dryden now, but I have my Victory Garden that I planted this year, and I got hit with the tomato blight, so all tomato plants were pulled and put in garbage bags. But I do have my own garden, and I do buy locally as much as I can, absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's important, too, just for the sake of the planet as well. Now, a few years ago, your life changed. You went in for a routine colonoscopy. And you ended up diagnosed with cancer. Tell us about it.
Well, I put it off for a year because I was pretty busy, and I had I had a symptom, but I didn't realize that it was a symptom of colon cancer. Basically, I'm a long-distance swimmer, and I had these back spasms for precedingly. They became more evident over time. But anyway, I never attached it, nor did anybody else, to cancer. And I don't even know if it was part of it. But when it was all over, I was able to swim again. But I went for colonoscopy, and as the doctor said, he tattooed a polyp that he could not remove, and that he was going to be getting it biopsied. Then I went on a trip to speak up in Maine. And halfway up there in New Hampshire, I called for the results, and he said it was cancerous. And though Dave, my husband now, his response was, your polyp has cancer. You don't have cancer.
Ah.
And I said, well, the polyp's connected to me, so I think I have cancer. But I wasn't devastated. That's the best way for me to put it. It was something that I wasn't surprised. Even though I really didn't have a symptom that I could connect with it, it didn't surprise me that I had cancer.
Why?
Because I led my life with my foot on the pedal pretty far down and in ways that weren't always healthy, because I worked really hard and Sometimes I'd work and there'd be no more gas in the tank and I'd still be going. And I felt as though this was a signal with that commercial, "Can you hear me now?" I felt like I had a bat over my head that from above that said, "Do you hear me now?" And it was definitely a signal that I needed to regroup. And all the activities, all the stress had been packaged into this toxic ball.
Mm.
And it was time for me to regroup and reassess.
And what was the first thing that you had to do after you learned that you had cancer? Did you have to decide what treatment, or is there just one treatment for colon
cancer?
Well,
they had to remove the polyp, so the first thing I had to do was have surgery. And I remember cooking for everybody in the hospital. I cooked cookies for the receptionists and the nurses and the anesthesiologists and the doctors. I had about 20 packages of cookies. And when it was over, the anesthesiologist came in to see me, and he said, "Do you know what you talked about when you were wheeled in?" And I thought, oh, Lord, with my brain, I have no idea what I might have said. And he said, "You described every cookie specifically to make sure that I understood what kind of cookies I'd be getting." And I thought I was pretty safe with that. And I had my surgery, and it was removed. And then they found out that I had stage 3C, which meant that it had it was in the lymph nodes. But, you know, stage 4 is the worst. Stage 3 is not great, but it's not the worst. And I had to proceed, and I did get a second opinion. I had a wonderful doctor here, Dr. Garbo.
Mm-hmm.
And a great team of people. Dr. Schwede did the surgery. Dr. Lemberg, who did the colonoscopy. I mean, really, just a team of remarkable people. And I still thought the due diligence of getting a second opinion.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea no matter what. If you're just joining us, my guest is Barbara Lang. She's currently an undergraduate advisor at Cornell University School of Hotel Administration, as well as a veteran of colon cancer, which is what we're talking about right now. Cancer takes you into a whole new landscape and a whole different world. Were you prepared for that?
When I got diagnosed and I recognized the path in front of me, the first thing I thought of was how to make this into a positive experience. And I thought, I'll have a soup business. I mean, people tell you that when people have cancer, they get sick and they need to only eat soup, and I'll have a soup business. And Dave and I actually brainstormed, and I did some research on soup production and how I could have this work so that I'd prepare the soups, and then this would be a business so people who had friends who had cancer, they could mail order the soups. And unfortunately, I had no interest in eating soup. I ate a lot of pasta, so that didn't quite work.
But you were following your philosophy of not slowing down by trying to do that.
No,
weren't
I'm
you?
A hypocrite. I
no,
absolutely.
Not a hypocrite, but you weren't ready to slow down at that point, were you?
I guess there's different definitions of slowing down. I like projects. I am hardwired that way. And I just looked at this as how can I had always wondered how I'd respond when the proverbial you-know-what hit the fan.
I think
a
lot of people think about that.
And I realized this was an opportunity, and I was confident that regardless of how the path was going to unfold, it was how I responded to it. You know, we can look at things differently, and it's a choice. I mean, this is mm-hmm. what it is, and I have a remarkably supportive family, and Dave, you know, was right there. My sister Susan was right there. My kids were great. I had a circle of friends, so I wasn't alone.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know,
and you were planning for the future.
Absolutely, from the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And the day that I got diagnosed, I started writing, and then that became an editorial because I sent it into the Ithaca Journal, and it got published the day I had surgery, and they asked me if I would mind, and that's sort of what I was thinking. Wouldn't that be good timing? Uh-huh. And they did, and then they asked me if I would write a column, and it was a fabulous way for me to channel what I was going through.
Uh-huh. I was going to ask you about that. Did you have any hesitation at all to make this what many people think of as a very personal, you know, journey into such a public forum?
People who know me know I'm shameless. So I did not look at it as something. I wasn't embarrassed by it. One person, when they found out that I had colon cancer, they went, "Oh, you have the embarrassing cancer."
Oh, that's ridiculous.
But you have to realize when people respond,
uh-huh.
they're saying more about themselves than they are
they
anything
are.
Else.
They
and
are.
For them, it was a very embarrassing uh-huh. circumstance. For me, there was an irony to it because I exercise, I eat really healthfully, I eat minimal red meat.
And you're a swimmer. And...
Right. So none of that was really contributing to it. It just, it was what it was.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, 30, 40 years ago, cancer itself was considered an embarrassment, remember?
Yes.
I mean, people wouldn't even use the C word. They'd say the C word.
Right.
Instead of the word cancer even. So we've come a long way.
We have come a long way. And it also is not, as people said, it's not the death sentence that it used to be, that people go on with their lives having gone through it because the treatment is as good as it is and it only gets better.
Uh-huh. And how was the treatment for you? Was that a hard time physically and emotionally, as you hear a lot of people describe?
Sure, there were parts of it. I mean, you get reactions to it. I had a port put in, which meant that they could have direct access into the chemotherapy. Mm-hmm. But even at the chemotherapy, every time I went to get chemo, I baked. And I'd bake for the office, and I'd bake for the nurses. And by the end, they were so conditioned for expecting desserts that when my last dessert was going to be cream puffs or eclairs, and I told them that the filling I was going to make just whipped cream, and it was, you're not making a pastry cream? You know, their standards had really gone up a little bit, but I made a pastry cream for them. It was fine.
You made it into a good experience. You're a very positive person, obviously.
I guess so. I've never viewed myself that way. Again, I had a lot of support. And I also used the resources that were here in Ithaca. I used the Cancer Resource Center. I corresponded with Bob Ritter. I did the column. Mm-hmm. I did a retreat. I didn't isolate myself.
Yeah. And do you recommend that to people with cancer, if they can possibly do that? Reach out instead of hide, which a lot of people do when they get sick, period?
It is such a personal decision. Mm. Some people, we all need different things at different times in different ways. Yeah. For me, I couldn't suddenly hibernate. But that's me. For other people, that might be what they need to do. My mother, when I was young, told me information can never hurt you. Mm. I mean, she told me that when I was 16. And I have always felt, look at the resources, find out what works. And if you decide that you don't want to pursue something, well, then don't. But at least be informed that it exists, as opposed to just shutting down and not being even open to information. It's like anything. It's a due diligence.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it harder for the people around you in some ways?
I think so.
Because, I mean, you're a positive person, but not everybody probably is a positive person around you, huh?
I think it was more difficult because for them, they had no control. I had a control over my attitude, and it was me that this was happening to. And it was something that I wasn't struggling with. But like anything, I mean, I grew up with a mother who had been ill almost all my life. It's very difficult when you're watching someone else and it's not you, and you become concerned and there's a frustration to it because there's not much that you can do, even though what I've learned after being ill was that just being acknowledged by people is something that I really appreciated. In other words, some people, when someone is ill, they don't know what to do, so they don't do anything.
Yeah, people act like they're afraid.
And they are afraid because it makes them very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And you have to recognize it's not because they don't care. Mm-hmm. It's just that they're uncomfortable. So you have to give everybody a little slack because everybody does it differently.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Bob Ritter wrote a really great column recently about come up and, you know, talk to people about it. Don't run away. You know, ask people how they are. It's okay.
But also be sensitive if they don't want to talk about it.
Exactly.
But most people don't want sympathy.
Right.
They don't want that feeling as though you're feeling sorry for them.
Yeah. Or that you're a victim.
Well, for me, that's why I always shy away. Not shy away. That's when I reject the word survivor. It just makes me cringe.
I was going to bring that up, yeah. You want to be called a cancer veteran.
If I'm going to be called anything. If you're going to categorize me, I suppose it's going to be a veteran. In other words, it happened, I went through it, and I move on. But I don't live my life with the cancer being a central part of who I am.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how has it changed you, though? Can you name some ways that...
Absolutely. I decided to retire at 55, and I don't think I ever would have considered that. I'll still work, and I've been at Cornell, and Cornell has been good to me, but 55, I get my health insurance, and I'm hitting the road. And in the past, I would have thought that might be an irresponsible or immature thing to do, and the cancer gave me permission. And even though I don't think I really needed permission, I viewed it that way with the idea that, you know, I'm not going to sit around and just wait until I should retire, those shoulds. I am going to go forth and move forward and do the things that I want to do.
Yeah, so it's given you a little bit of permission in some ways, or bravery, or...
I think it's more adolescent. I think it's permission. I don't think it's bravery.
So the fact that you survived this has made you go back into your second childishness.
Maybe, and the things that I started my career after college doing a variety of different adventures, and that's how I started my career, and I'd like to know... continue with that idea of being open to opportunities that come my way.
And do you have advice for people who may end up getting ill? Or do you think it's just such a personal journey you can't really give anybody specific advice?
I think probably the most helpful thing is to talk to someone who's been through the experience. And give the Cancer Resource Center a chance. Reach out and just find... Some people cringe at the idea of being with a self-help group.
Oh, indeed.
Others, they like that community. But tell the people at the Cancer Resource Center you'd like to talk to somebody who has had this experience, or you'd like to talk to a professional. But be an advocate for yourself.
Yeah, that's good advice. Really, really good advice to be an advocate and talk to people who've been through this instead of just... read books, because, I mean, personal experience is the only way to...
People gave me a lot of books, and I thank all those people for all those books. I never opened them.
Really?
I didn't.
What were they books of? Like people's
inspirational
own personal
books?
Oh, inspiration.
Lance Armstrong, A Woman Who Had Breast Cancer, another one about, oh, I don't know, you know, life with cancer, and they just were not, they didn't resonate with me. That's all. And that, again, that's a very personal... I didn't need that kind of assurance from those sources.
Yeah, I understand that. Some people do make their diseases into a career, which can be less than helpful to some people who don't really want to do that. But I understand the need to do it for some people.
But they might do it because selfishly that's what they needed to do with it.
Exactly.
So I don't judge anybody for the way in which they proceed.
Yeah. We only have a couple minutes left. What's happening in the future? You're going to retire and you have many things. You're going to continue working, you say? More entrepreneur ideas?
I do have a few entrepreneurial pursuits. Funny you should ask that. I will go with restaurant to retail and do consulting with inns and restaurants. And I have just finished consulting with a woman who actually was making truffle popcorn in North Carolina and growing truffles. And doing the first impression, second steps. And I'd like to widen my audience. As I said, I've done all of my presentations at Cornell. And I'd like to widen that not just to college students, but to high school students, to adults that want to change careers or are in the midst of changing careers. I just think that I've got something to offer that will make people feel better about themselves and feel more empowered. Mm-hmm. And I just finished cooking on a schooner for 8 days on a tall ship, and they've invited me back again, and I might do that. I'm not quite sure.
Oh, how fun that sounds. Now, is there a way people can get in touch with you? Do you have a website?
I do have two websites.
Okay.
One is restauranttoretail.com, and the other website is firstimpressions-secondsteps.com. And again, that's firstimpressions-secondsteps.com.
That's great. Well, Barbara Lang, thank you so much for coming and sharing your story with us. You're a great inspiration.
Well, Jay, thanks.
And good luck.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.